You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Mickey.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm fine.
Look, it's a famous actor. Wait, who is that? You know who it looks like, but isn't. It actually looks like kind of Sean Penn, but it's a different actor, right?
Correct.
Who is the famous actor who it turns out looks like Sean Penn? Who is that?
The great actor who, like, I don't think won many awards. Famous for a film noir.
It's so going to be so embarrassing that the name didn't come to mind. What's his name?
No. Robert Mitchum.
Robert Mitchum. Yeah.
And I claim that Robert Mitchum looks, like with his tousled hair, like Ron DeSantis should look. Ron DeSantis has been in a couple of events where he's had windblown hair and he looks terrific. So he should adopt the secret of Boris Johnson and mess up his hair.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to go full, yeah, Miele or wherever that Argentine guy is.
No.
But a little Boris Johnson.
I think that's the only missing ingredient. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's the only thing the DeSantis formula lacks is must up hair. Because he's got everything else.
There have been all these postmortems, you know, about how he was scared of the press. He didn't want to do the press. He was arrogant. Mm-hmm. He hired all Ted Cruz's people for some reason, solely to prevent them from going to Glen Youngkin. I don't think that's right. But this was the secret, lying in plain sight. I mean, his hair is like greased down. It's nailed down. He needs to unnail it down.
I think you've hit it. Yeah. You could make a good living as a political consultant, Mickey.
I actually tried that a little bit, like yesterday. It was a disaster.
Oh, did you? Well, we should say you are on the campaign trail. You are in New Hampshire, following in the footsteps of the great Hunter S. Thompson, to whom many have compared you.
Well, he famously declared it was a complete fiction, I think, that Edwin Muskie was an Ibogaine addict. Remember that?
It was
obviously a joke, but he extended it, like, you know, he didn't say it was a joke. He said, I have just learned that Edward Muskie has become addicted to a powerful drug, Ibogaine. And then, of course, when Muskie cried on, you know, allegedly cried,
he said,
outside a news in New Hampshire.
He was crashing. He ran out of Ibogaine.
Now, it looked like
he
was going through Ibogaine withdrawal. Yes.
For our younger viewers, we should say that Hunter S. Thompson wrote for the Rolling Stone, and part of his so-called gonzo journalism was this kind of blurring of fact and fiction. I mean, you could kind of tell what the fiction was, but he would throw it in all the time. And of course, he was no stranger to drugs himself, one might say, and finally committed suicide.
Did he?
Oh, yeah, totally. And you know who he turned out to be good friends with? This is a tribute to Walter Isaacson. Now, Walter Isaacson is a total establishment figure, but it turns out he had been hanging out with Hunter S. Thompson. You know why?
Because he wanted to do a book about it.
No, because Walter was president of the Aspen Institute. That meant he went to Aspen sometimes. And where did Hunter Thompson live until he killed himself there?
Well, Gary Hart was a friend of Hunter Thompson, too.
So was George McGovern.
I thought Ibogaine was a fictitious drug, but it turns out it's a real drug, but I don't think Muskie was. Anyway, Hunter Thompson was onto the fact that Muskie was a heavy drinker and was known for his temper fits and emotionalism. And so it fed into the press corps. And when Muskie allegedly cried, they jumped all over Muskie.
So wait.
Whoa.
This is such a great segue. I can't pass it up. Okay. We got to move to Biden quickly. Just for a second, you'll get to do your well-prepared spiel. I mean, I know you were up all night preparing for this. We're not going to deprive you of that. Don't worry. Hold on. Listen, wait a second. Joe Biden, I have not given up my effort to dislodge him from the Democratic ticket. And I would just like to say something about, was Muskie 72 or he was 68 or so? He was 72. So never mind. But I would like to use 72 as a segue to 68, which is what I want to actually talk about. New Hampshire primary. 1968, LBJ, incumbent, who's getting some blowback from the left wing of the party for some military activity that isn't popular on the left. So far as we know, he's running. He's going to be the nominee. Everything will work out wonderfully. However, he barely won New Hampshire because Eugene McCarthy was contesting it. And what did that do? Yeah.
A relatively unknown Minnesotan, you might have.
Oh, that's a good point. He was a Minnesotan, like Dean Phillips? This is, folks, again, this is the kind of magic that happens when Mickey and I talk. So wait, now, what did that do? That close call, among other things, encouraged others to enter the race, including one Bobby Kennedy. Of course, in this year, Bobby Kennedy is already in the race, but not the Democratic race. And so that just opened the floodgates. And it is, I mean, look, I'm not that optimistic. And I suspect that it's harder to enter primaries late, the way Bobby Kennedy evidently did now than it used to be.
Ukraine is not Vietnam.
No, I'm thinking more about Israel. The blowback from the left is not about Ukraine. It's about
Israel. Okay, but the blowback to Vietnam was nominally on the left, but it in fact reflected a widespread disgust with Vietnam.
The analogy is not perfect.
Beyond the left, and also, anyway, the Democratic Party now is much more disciplined than it was then. And they, as Dean Phillips said, the guy who's running against Biden now, who I still hold out some hope might do better than expected, which expectations are very low. They're council level low, 5%. What was my train of thought?
I'll point out that Biden, while you're getting it, summoning it, I will say that Biden is not on the ballot.
Oh,
so he Biden points out he was a write-in vote. Yeah.
Dean Phillips points out that as soon as he entered the race, he was excommunicated by the Democratic Party. And it's just a much more, disciplined, viciously unified organization. Otherwise, guys like Pritzker would have jumped in.
But Biden, blowback
will be too severe. With an iron fist, he's leading his party over a cliff.
Look, yeah, Biden is. But since all those people made the decision not to run months and months ago, things have come to look much, much worse for Biden in the general election. The polls.
Well, lately there have been some positive signs that the economy is looking up and eventually, voters might get the message that things aren't going all to hell.
The poll numbers are bad. The Gaza thing, I repeat, I think has enduringly reduced his ability to mobilize like young volunteers. There's true discontent among young Democrats with that. And we'll see. I mean, but my question is, is it too late for some big name to jump in if Dean Phillips does better than we expect or something?
The answer is, I don't know. I've read a bunch of articles saying, yes, it's too late. But I sort of never believe it's too late. So, and if Biden, withdraws from the race, then the party has to do something. So,
yeah.
That's what I'm eating my Sudafed now.
You're taking your Sudafed. It's a little late to really perk you up. You definitely should snort it. You definitely should snort it, Mickey.
Oh.
That would be ratings gold. You talk about your thumbs ups on YouTube, which you should do, folks, just because he swallowed it so masterfully. But you really should.
It's only the cheap Walmart Sudafed equivalent. One of the virtues of being on the road in a car is that you go to Walmart and you realize what a fucking amazing store that is. Anyway.
Got a lot of stuff packed into,
Also, it's incredibly cheap. It's just absurd. Anyway, That's how America has gotten by during the Biden years. So that's Biden. Okay. I was thinking that, basically the lesson of the New Hampshire primary is it ain't what it used to be. This is a boring year. I may even leave town before the vote, just because I've seen Haley. I've seen Haley twice, which is once more than I ever want to do. I'm going to go see Trump tonight. Once you've seen each candidate once, because Haley gives the same stump speech over and over again. She doesn't even really improve it, which is the mark of not a very effective candidate. This is the reporters aren't here. I'll be amazed if there's an influx even on election night. I haven't discovered the bar where all the journalists hang out, in part because I don't think the journalists really are here in any great numbers, and in part because I don't know any journalists anymore. But so it's not an exciting New Hampshire primary. Iowa is actually more exciting. But what has happened is that DeSantis is edging ahead of Haley in Iowa has really put a damper on her momentum. If she had come in second in Iowa, I mean, it's very unfair that a few thousand votes separating second and third has a big impact, but it happens all the time, especially in Iowa. And she hasn't come into New Hampshire with the momentum she might have had if she had done just a little better. It's pretty clear that she's going to lose. And the question is just how decisively she will lose. And the positive scenario for Mickey is she loses so decisively and then goes down to South Carolina and loses decisively again there that she leaves the race, leaving DeSantis as the only opponent. So DeSantis soldiers on, as I think he intends to do, getting a few votes, getting a few delegates, and then something happens to Trump and DeSantis wins. Yay! because he's learned to tousle his hair.
Does anyone other than you think this is possible?
That is
you and DeSantis, yes. I mean.
This has been bandied about as the only strategy that's available to him is soldiering on. And then, it always becomes a money problem. And it is true that DeSantis has been used to spending vast sums of money, mainly through his super PAC, which did pay off a bit. He got 5 extra points beyond the last polls because he had a superior ground operation. So that's not nothing. What do you want for $170 million?
Hey, I just had a great idea that it's too late for, but Haley refuses to debate DeSantis if Trump isn't going to be there because she just wants to completely marginalize him. So they canceled the debate. Why doesn't DeSantis debate Dean Phillips? Good for both of them, right? Win-win.
That is a good idea.
Of course it's a good idea.
It's too late, but I will suggest it.
So it's not a good idea, but it was a good idea. They should do it for... They're both going to... I guess Trump on down to South Carolina, right?
And the media will dismiss it as the Mickey Mouse debate among the.
It's still I'll bet they can find some station to air it, streaming.
What else?
Anything.
And what else do they have to cover?
Right.
Anyway, I went to a Haley event. She has some capability of spontaneity. She bantered with the governor of New Hampshire, who is her biggest supporter here. He's very popular. I sort of don't like him because he's like a, conventional.
Who is the governor of New Hampshire?
Sununu's son.
Still Sununu?
His son.
How long has he been there? No, I know. The son's been in New Hampshire politics. It seems like he's been governor for a long time.
Correct. But as soon as she goes on autopilot and starts the stump speech, your sort of heart sinks. Even people who haven't heard it before, maybe their heart doesn't sink. But it's not a very good stump speech. It starts off talking about the debt and how we've accumulated debt. And isn't it time for an accountant in the White House? Okay. And
that is so fucking stupid.
That's so stupid. And then eventually she gets to some good parts. She talks, the high point was she talks about veterans care and the way to ensure good VA care is require congressmen to get their care from the VA. soon.
Okay, you know, that's a little good, but because it strikes a little bit of a populist chord. These out-of-touch congressmen, they're that's not bad.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then she talks about the humiliation of us leaving Bagram Air Force Base in the middle of the night without telling our allies, which was humiliating. It doesn't explain how we got in that situation because we listened to the advice of people like
Nick Haley. I'm sure that's
in Afghanistan way too long.
I'm sure that's foremost on the mind of New Hampshire voters, right? Wish we had gotten out of Afghanistan more.
It was at least a human. It was a human emotion she had.
It's just off, come on.
You think campaigns about the issues? They're about assessing the candidate. Okay,
they're about stirring people's emotions.
You have to seduce the voters and convince them you're the person for them. Okay, you can't just recite a list of issues and they're going to vote for you.
Right. And so you think they're thinking, yeah, she'll get us out of our next ill-advised war more gracefully or something? I mean, you know, no.
Yes. We would still be.
Americans do not care about foreign policy, Mickey.
Doesn't this contradict your theory that Biden is going to lose because of Hamas?
Well, young activist types who might otherwise be volunteers in Biden's campaign, yes, a fair amount of them do care about that. But that's not a large fraction of the electorate.
Anyway, I kept thinking of, you know, if you
get a speech, that's a much more immediate issue. I mean, Afghanistan is yesteryear, you know. But
if you give a speech 100, well, it's when Biden's popularity plummeted, though. That's whether I thought we should withdraw too, but whether you like it or not, that's when his popularity fell to the floor.
Yeah, but that doesn't. Republican voters don't care when his fucking popularity. Never mind. We don't have to litigate
this. It's a damaging issue. If you're a Republican running against Biden, you bring up Afghanistan. I'm sorry, even if it's old news, it's a. Something that it's like Hunter Biden.
Well, okay, so I guess
that's Biden to the quick.
Kind of. I mean, to the extent that you attack Joe Biden, that's a good thing. I just don't know that this is the most resonant attack, and I'm sure she has others. Here's my question. Well, were you going to say more?
Yes, I had two more points.
Okay.
Remember your question.
Don't worry.
If you have a big stump speech and your entire candidacy rests on it, or if you're a preacher in a church and just giving a speech on Sunday every week, you go for the most telling anecdote that's going to bring tears to your audience's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I was thinking of, like, I heard Jason DePaul give a talk about his book about welfare people in Milwaukee, and he had some anecdotes that just ripped your heart out. Okay. Yeah. And I think of them again and I start crying again. Okay. Haley had nothing to that. She had all the consultants in the world, all the money in the world. She didn't bother to come up with a good anecdote. So her candidacy is sort of a couple bricks shy of alone. The second thing is, of course, she talks about her husband coming back from Iraq and having PTSD, couldn't be around loud noises, didn't want to be in part of crowds, blah, blah, blah. And of course, there's also some under news in the campaign, which is the Nikki Haley sex scandal.
Mm-hmm.
How could New Hampshire not be exciting if there's a sex scandal? Answer it, because the press is not reporting it, because the entire sex scandal is just she had an affair with a couple of campaign aides when she was running for governor, and everybody decides that's not worth reporting. And I agree that's not worth reporting.
But it kind of undercuts the traumatic.
But with John Edwards, it was worth reporting because he was basing his entire emotional pitch of his campaign on his loyalty to his dying wife. Okay. In the quiet of a hospital room, we decided to run for president, blah, blah, blah. And women liked him because he was loyal to his dying wife, but he wasn't loyal to his dying wife. So if he's cheating on his dying wife, that's relevant, okay? She's coming close to the line when she boasts about how she was loyal to her husband who was overseas. If you could show she was cheating when he was overseas, seems to me that's worth reporting. This story did not do that. It was not when he was overseas, but I don't think. But you know,
that's what she should emphasize. I've never cheated on my husband while he was overseas. That's exactly what I would lead with if I were her.
He put a lid on it. It's, you know, it's like no more sex till he comes back.
Yeah. So what's your third?
Those are the two things I had to say.
Oh, that's two. Okay.
You didn't know about the Nikki Haley sex scandal, did you?
I didn't even know about the PTSD.
Okay.
So is she giving Trump shit for getting her mixed up with Nancy Pelosi?
I don't know if she's done that yet. My line was going to be there, but for the grace of God, go I. It's the sort of thing I would do, except clearly it was worse than that because he had somehow fixated on Nikki Haley as the personification of evil. So he mentally substituted her for Nancy Pelosi. I think that's it.
Yeah, I think he's got first of all, I want to read the quote because it wasn't just like one, you know, did you see exactly what he said? I mean,
I watched the video.
It raises cognitive issues. So because he says, okay, by the way, they never report the crowd on January 6th, you know, Nikki Haley says it three times. Did you know they destroyed all of the information, all of the evidence, everything, deleted and destroyed all of it, because of lots of things like Nikki Haley is in charge of security. We offered her 10,000 people, soldiers, National Guards, whatever they want. So he says her name four times. I think that's weird. I'm sorry.
It seems deeply addled, like he just woke up from a dream or something.
Yeah, exactly. You know, but,
like he's on drugs.
And clearly he has a part of his brain that is like women I'm trashing and don't really hate. And at least two women are in it. And then there may be subdivisions in that, like name begins within. And he was in that part of the basement. But
it was clearly the women I'm trashing.
Yeah.
Does he not like Nancy Pelosi? He really should like Nancy Pelosi. She's really done a number on him.
Well, in a way, I wonder whether he's not sufficiently psychopathic that he doesn't truly hate anyone, you know, but no, sometimes it's hard to say. I don't know.
Wait, if he's more psychopathic, he doesn't hate them?
Well, psychopaths are just more clinical, supposedly. They're more like removed from their feeling. I mean, they do have vendettas and so on and hatred, but I don't know. None of my good friends are psychopaths, so far as I know.
They are sort of, they're both, I won't, anyway, Nikki Haley is tiny. Have I mentioned that?
No.
The reason the phrase, Trump calls her bird brain, the reason why that resonates is because she is like a little bird. Her face looks sort of hawkish, mm-hmm. and she's tiny. She's like a little frail bird. Although not,
but hawks are not frail birds, Mickey. If she looks hawkish,
she has a beak.
She is hawkish,
but you know she doesn't look frail when she's talking, and you can't see how short she is. And she's pretty dynamic. But anyway, she's not going to make
it. My choice would be DeSantis. I want to go on the record as saying that of those three, I would choose DeSantis.
Thank you.
The least bad outcome.
We should do. He should embrace that. He should embrace put in fingers. He should. You know, that was the most telling Trump attack on him.
I missed it. What was that?
There was some quote in a Daily Beast story that he once ate chocolate pudding with his three fingers because he didn't have utensils. And so Trump did this disgusting ad of this guy who wanted to cut Social Security with his pudding fingers, and it just looked like they had shit on them. His chocolate pudding was completely disgusting, but very effective. The thing to do when people label you like that is to embrace it and turn it around.
Totally.
Flip the script, as they say, in a phrase I never know what it means, but I think it would mean that.
I think it's like jujitsu. It's like a jujitsu move,
yeah,
right?
He could have embraced the put in figures, and people could have held up their brown fingers at rallies, you know. DeSantis. It would have been great.
don't you think that really, if you're going to be honest about the Republican race, which I know pains you because it means acknowledging that Ron DeSantis is not going to be the nominee and Donald Trump is, but if one were honest about the actual lack of drama in the Republican race, is it possible that there's actually more drama on the Democratic side this time? Because after all, I mean, Biden's not on the ballot. Apparently, they're encouraging write-in votes for him so that Dean Phillips doesn't beat him. Dean Phillips is on the ballot. Of course, there's 20 other people on the ballot, apparently.
Johnson was a write-in candidate versus McCarthy, too.
Was he?
You're right. I mean, everybody thought neither party likes this candidate. This is now the conventional wisdom. It's 2 days old.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Halperin had it 2 days ago, which is, or maybe it was John Ellis. Anyway, somebody pointed out, you can't say neither party likes this candidate because the Republicans decided they like Donald Trump. So they have their candidate. The Democrats are the people who still hate their candidate. And that's where the drama is. Yes.
What I wish we had is a Democratic challenger to Biden, not even a super famous one. I mean, it could be Dean Phillips level, but who, unlike Dean Phillips, is actually positioned to give Biden some heat from the left on Israel, Gaza. That could stir up some action. You would get a lot of volunteers helping you out right away. That would, it's a debate worth having. It would be good to put pressure on Biden to finally get around to actually trying to use some leverage with Netanyahu. I mean, that's my view anyway.
Why couldn't Cornel West do that? I guess now he can because
he's not taken seriously. He's not, and he's an independent. He's not running in the Democratic side anyway, is he? Or is he? Is he?
No, he's running as an independent. He's not running on the Democratic side.
Marianne Williams or Williamson, whatever it is, she is running. She's on the ballot, I think, and so is Dean Phillips, and so apparently are 19 other people, if I understand it correctly. But
didn't you have her on Blogging Heads?
She was on Blogging Heads, as I told you. There was a certain amount of obvious, chemistry between Marianne and me. She was. I don't want to say she was smitten, but I think she was smitten.
The high point of my trip, Bob, is I was in a bar in Des Moines, and I was staring at Carrie Lake, and she smiled at me, Bob.
Really?
I thought something going on.
That's amazing, because politicians don't just go around smiling at anybody, So you should be
That's what I realized. Most normal people, when somebody stares at you, they'll stare back or walk away. If you're a politician, you'll smile at them. That's what politicians do, right?
Yeah.
So
I have a related story that would be parrot room material, so I won't tell it.
Anyway. I think you should be required to be for Marianne Williamson just because you want a Blogging Heads person.
I'm on board for her. I think Dean Phillips has more of a, he's actually in Congress, so people take him like a little bit seriously. Now, I want to say something. Go ahead.
Well, we each have our pet issues waiting in the wings. You can talk about pressuring Netanyahu, and I could talk about Biden's pathetic, desperate attempt to save his ass from his immigration failure. But go ahead.
Well, Phillips,
what were you going to say first?
I want to say something about Phillips. I mean, last time I was very dismissive of him and compared him to Ramaswamy. And I do think that comparison holds. I went back, but
he's not an asshole like Ramaswamy.
No, but I mean, he's a good talker who's pretty good at saying things that get people's attention and get them to go, yeah, but it just doesn't add up. And he doesn't have any idea of how the world actually works. So he says crazy shit about what he would do as president. And I will actually play a recording of him saying what in my mind is some crazy shit in a second. But on the positive side, so I went back and listened to him on the All In podcast. This was like a couple of months ago, I think. And I will say, and as you know, he seems to be pro engagement on China. I like that. And he even did say it was stupid of Biden to call Xi a dictator. I like that. He's got some good things, but it just like, for example, he's like when David Sachs brought up Ukraine, he says, well, in mistake, it was in 2014 you know, Crimea is where we should have drawn a line. You know, we gave him an inch and now he's taking a mile. And it's like, and nobody followed up and said, wait a second, you're saying you would have gone to war over Ukraine? Like, how would you have exactly stopped
over Crimea, even worse than Ukraine, over Crimea?
No, I mean Crimea. That's what I mean, Crimea. You would have gone to war over Crimea. This is, remember, Putin didn't even have to fight for it. The sentiment among both like officials and the grassroots was so pro-Russian that they just, you know, sent in a bunch of guys and power was handed over. And like, so right. What, you're going to go occupy a country where, you know, most people actually were in favor of Putin running the, I mean, this is just crazy shit. The idea of going to war with Russia over Crimea, okay, but that's not what I want to play for you. I want to play for you the part where he's talking about, so this was some weeks after October 7th, and he says, so first of all, he says he's about to issue a statement demanding the release of the hostages. I think that's extremely courageous of him, and I'm sure that'll work. But I want to, you know, we're talking about the Hamas hostages.
Right.
But I want to play the rest of it. Okay, so here we go.
Missiles in Gaza, and it's got to stop. I am about to issue a statement to that end that says, essentially, Hamas must release all of its hostages, period, of which there are 9 Americans, guys. 9 Americans are being held in Gaza by a terrorist organization. And as president, I would be making that not my daily desire or request, my daily demand. All hands on deck. These hostages must be released immediately.
Would you send in special forces to collect them?
I would. Absolutely. It is incumbent on the president of the United States to extract Americans being held against their will by any foreign entity. I don't know. Got to ask him. But good luck asking him because he doesn't do any press conferences.
The goal for peace is reasonable, but these, like, maybe some specifics around your strategy.
So okay, so first, at the moment the hostages are safely released, there should be a ceasefire, period. And at that very moment, there should be a multinational peacekeeping force sent into Gaza to maintain security immediately. When I say multinational, the very nations that are connected to Gaza, Arab nations, have to be part of it. Not the United States, not Israel, of course, but a significant force there to keep the peace immediately. Concurrently, a multinational coalition designed to eliminate Hamas by every nation in the world that wants them eliminated, which frankly is most. And then we have got to invest again. Nations of the world investing.
I mean, where do I begin? Like, he's going to send special forces to Gaza to ensure that the hostages get killed while along with a few of the special forces. I mean, you know, if that were doable, I think Israel would have done it. They know that territory pretty well. And they, you know, there's that. There's like multinational force, but not America, to occupy Gaza. First of all, virtually nobody wants to do that. But above all, a multinational coalition to eliminate what? So that's going to be a military operation. And I've got some bad news. There is no country in the entire region other than Israel that wants to be seen as trying to eliminate Hamas. There are rulers who would like Hamas eliminated, but there are none who are going to who are going to go on record saying, yep, here's our troops, do your best. I mean, this is just fantasy land.
Correct. It's pretty immature for a politician to say that. Gene McCarthy, in sharp contrast, would have never said anything like that.
No, I know.
Of course, he had a huge, big issue that he didn't have to say anything about, which is Vietnam. He didn't have to say, okay, we're going to send a multinational force into Vietnam or come up with some crazy-ass scheme. All he had to do was say, we're going to end the war. But he was a sophisticated man who was way beyond that.
No, it's sad. I mean, we deserve better. So that's why my hope is that he will play the Eugene McCarthy role in the sense of doing well enough that it opens up the race, although I'm sure that's fantasy land too, and it's actually too late for anything to happen. But Tim Kaine, I repeat, Tim Kaine is the guy, and he's also the guy to put pressure on Biden over Gaza. He's sponsoring resolutions along with a few other senators about Gaza. He's the guy, Tim Kaine.
Tim Kaine is just like Phillips's multinational force. It's your delusion as to how this is going to end. Tim Kaine is going to march in and solve everything.
No, but Mickey, you didn't understand. I'm issuing a statement today calling for him to enter the race, okay?
But
does that change your mind?
But the search for the Kwisatz Haderach, the perfect Democrat who is ambitious enough to want to get into the race and distant enough for the Democratic establishment that he's willing to defy, he or she is willing to defy them, yet popular enough that he or she will pose a real threat, is not crazy. I think maybe there is such a person out there.
And the sad thing is they would probably beat Trump. It's not hard to find a candidate who can beat Trump.
Maybe somebody in the entertainment industry, Jon Stewart.
No, I think you need somebody with political cred. We don't need more celebrity bullshit. But
times are desperate. Celebrity bullshit gains new appeal.
My final question to draw on your vast knowledge of politics. It's an unpredictable path forward. Suppose things start looking hopeless for Biden, but he has amassed a lot of delegates. Or for whatever reason, he decides, okay, I give up. He's just not doing well enough. Can any candidate just release their delegates?
Sure.
Okay. That's my new hope.
But it has to be done at the convention. It's not going to be somebody jumping in before the convention and beating him. Now, in a lot of presidential races, the winning candidate starts losing primaries toward the end as there's a buyer's remorse. So it's not crazy that DeSantis could be the recipient of a bit of buyer's remorse toward the end. His mistakes really have been sort of tactical, putting all this money into a pack he didn't control. There's a lot of the post board said, he shouldn't have gone. Instead of declaring for president, he did a book tour, which is his fake declaration for president, where he could run around the country but not declare. And people said that just made him a sitting duck for Trump. He should have just declared. So he made a lot of mistakes, but they tended to be he didn't give media interviews for a while initially, and then he realized that was a mistake. Most of his mistakes have been tactical, not in terms of governing or policy. Or substance. So the basis for and he's getting better on the stump and better with people and et cetera, et cetera. So, if John Fetterman can come back from his depression, Ron DeSantis can come back from his misanthropy. I think it's possible that he has a resurgence toward the end. But I don't see on the Democratic side, unless you have a horse, I don't see a resurgence. Don't you remember when Jerry Brown started beating Jimmy Carter at the end of 1976? Because people sort of said, well, we're not sure we like this guy, Carter. And Brown won a couple of primaries in a row and became a serious threat.
Final hope is that, there is a little bit of a campaign in New Hampshire to write in ceasefire. On the Democratic side, that's your candidate, ceasefire.
Can I write in no fully refundable child tax credit?
Yeah, you can do that. Why don't you organize that on the Republican side?
Okay, I have to switch my residency, but I'll do that.
So
the other factor hurting Biden is that all these Democrats are jumping in the Democratic. All these independents are jumping in the Democratic, jumping in the Republican primary to vote for Haley. So they're not around to vote for Biden. Well, it's possible that people who hate Trump also hate Trump enough that they really worry about Biden, and they would just as soon vote for Dean Phillips.
Yeah.
So maybe it's hurting Phillips.
Do you know who Dean Phillips is? Step grandmother technically, but his father died in Vietnam when he was 6 months old. So this is the only father he knows, and apparently
I knew that, but I've forgotten it.
Dear Abby is the correct answer. The famous...
Dear Abby was the stepfather?
No, was the mother of the stepfather, I think. Because he says that Dear Abby is his grandmother and Ann Landers is his aunt. They are sisters, of course, yeah. Dear Abby and Ann Landers.
Yeah.
No, he married into a liquor... his mother married into a liquor family Phillips Schnapps.
The guy who ghost wrote Dear Abby lived down the street from me. You know, she had writers. Anyway, it's we're still in exactly the same dilemma we were a year ago, except the dilemma is congealing around our ankles like cement.
Now we're screwed. I mean, we broadly, America, the world, and so on. You want to talk? I want to say more about foreign policy, but you want to talk about immigration first.
Yeah, no, I'm trying to think of this, you know, the Biden problem is really the Kamala Harris problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, even I would stomach four more years of Biden if you could press a button and guarantee he would not never cede his presidency to Kamala Harris.
Mm.
So I think people should focus on that problem rather than the anti-Biden problem.
Well, I just, like, between Ukraine and Gaza, I just, you know, it's just turning out that his foreign policy is bad as anybody else's, it, by my lights, by my ideological lights. And so.
Let's talk about that. You said Biden could finally use leverage with Netanyahu. Well, hasn't he used all the leverage he has? He's been trying.
He's used Netanyahu's zero leverage. He's used none. No, I mean, this is the thing. We are so conditioned to politicians, you know, walking, respecting the political guardrails on Israel that we never imagine them actually using leverage. Okay. We are providing all of the weapons and the ammo that they're using. Now, there's enough in the pipeline that they could keep going for a while, but I guarantee you that. I mean, let's just imagine a world where you didn't consider Israel the third rail and could actually use the kind of leverage that we associate with superpowers and supposed client states, right? I mean, What you do is, you know, you show Netanyahu a statement that you're going to make if he doesn't do X, Y, and Z. And the state, for example, and here's, I want to say one thing while, folks, Mickey has disappeared and he's doing God knows what. We'll be dialing 911 if he doesn't show up soon. Let me first of all say the kind of thing two things you might do, you know. You might say, here's the thing that's not appreciated, is that Biden could get tough with Israel in certain ways and really not court nearly as much trouble as he apparently fears from the Israel lobby, and certainly not from Jewish voters, by and large, or at least the ones who would vote for him anyway. That has to do with the fact that Bibi Netanyahu is very unpopular among Israelis, among American Jews, and so are the people on the right wing of his cabinet. So if Biden wanted to say, look, you know, these guys, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir, they are saying they want ethnic cleansing, okay? And almost in so many words, it's very clear. And I want them to both renounce it. And if you don't get them to do it, I will do X, Y, and Z. Now, that battle he could go public with, okay? And it wouldn't hurt him much. I mean, I don't know what actual elements of a literal, like, AIPAC and so on would do. But in terms of, like, donors, I think, by and large, and whoever the hell else he cares about.
That's the worst of both worlds. You're meddling in a country's politics, which you have no business doing, and you're not stopping the war. So Netanyahu with the war.
You ask how much leverage there is. Okay, here's what leverage would be. Again, imagine, let's go back to the world where there's no political guardrails. You might first show Bibi this statement you're going to deliver, and then you would actually deliver it if he didn't, whatever. The statement is, look, we have some problems here. Actual cabinet members seem to favor ethnic cleansing, okay? And their plan for Gaza is to actually relocate all the Gazans And we can't put up with that. So I am suspending the flow of weapons to Israel for 1 week and see if anybody will reconsider. Now, will Biden do that? No, I'm just saying that's how you actually would use leverage if you weren't deathly afraid of what the political blowback would be. I mean, even.
But it's not Israel's policy to relocate the Gazans yet, is it? It's just these guys' policy.
No, you would say, look, I am not going to send weapons to a government that is conducting this war in Gaza and includes cabinet members who are saying this. So I'm waiting for them to renounce it. Now, this might lead to the fall of the Netanyahu government, which, by the way, most American Jews would love. OK, they would love that outcome. And so would most Israelis. So I'm just saying, there are certain kinds of issues. To the extent that it looks like a war between Biden and Netanyahu, that's not a very unpopular thing in the community he's worried about. OK, and the but you could equally well say, look, they just are not being. We've asked again and again to be more careful about civilian casualties, to pause the fighting and let more stuff in. Bibi keeps saying no. So we're gonna pause the flow of weapons and just wait and see what happens. That would be a fucking earthquake in Israel, okay? That would be an earthquake. And it would probably lead Bibi to either do whatever Biden said he wanted him to do or to fall, okay? The government would fall because, but Biden, but again, and don't come back and say, but wouldn't that hurt Biden? I'm telling you right now what the leverage is. Do I think Biden is? I'm not denying there's political blowback. The Israel lobby is powerful.
I wasn't going to say that. I'm not sure that the political consequences are what Biden fears. I think he's doing sort of what he, what the blob believes should be done.
Well, that's fearing the political. That's a form of fear of the political consequences. The blob exacts penalties, but the blob
might feel that this is like Russia's invasion of Ukraine. What Hamas did cannot go unpunished. So you gotta let the Israelis punish it.
The blob's not nearly as unified on this issue. There are lots of actual blob members who would love to see a ceasefire. Lots. Now they may not
You can illustrate it with like a blob dividing in two.
Yeah, it's actually a good point. It's a point worth making. The blob is divided on, they're not super vocal about it. But there are not many people vocally defending what Israel is doing right now in America, foreign policy elites.
There are always Arabists in the blob.
What does that mean?
It wasn't the standard objection to State Department realists was that they were all Arabists who just went over to Saudi Arabia and got taken in by the Saudi worldview, which is not pro at the time was
that's much, what the pro-Israel people said.
Much, much less pro-Israel than it is now. What about this McGurk story that I sent you?
You mean the HuffPost issue or
yeah.
I mean McGurk, I gather, is the
you should explain who McGurk is, because I've sort of forgotten.
McGurk. He was in Trump's administration, wasn't he? And he's
I think he quit Trump's administration in protest against our abandonment of our Syrian positions. I may be wrong.
Well, that says it all. And Biden, for whatever reason, has given him some Middle East portfolio in the White House. And he is, according to reporting in HuffPost, and I think the White House set about kind of trying to slime the reporter who wrote this. But according to various reporting, I mean, McGurk is very influential in driving the policy. And there was a HuffPost piece that said that he's, just pushing this extremely hawkishly pro-Israel stuff. I don't remember the details. Is that what you said? Did you send me the HuffPost piece?
Or? Well, I thought he's basically, his solution to the problem is, Let's rev up the Abraham Accords,
right,
where it's all there's a Saudi Israel alliance and maybe including Iran, but
no,
but
I don't think so. No. No, the whole point of the Abraham Accords is to alienate and exclude Iran, and it's
okay. But it seems to me it was Saudis, Israel, and somebody else. Maybe.
Well, it could be
the rest.
I mean, who has not yet signed on to the normalization? As UAE, I forget which countries have already signed on to the Abraham Accords.
Is there any hope of splitting Iraq off of Iran? No.
I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't know. Iraq has lately been demanding that we leave the country, but of course, we never do. Our troops are apparently not welcome there. It's getting complicated, you know. There was this dust up between Iran and Pakistan, which seems to have been resolved perhaps with the behind the scenes intermediation of China, which continues to be the only great power that ever plays a constructive role in the Middle East. They had also brokered this rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and Biden's intense desire to revive the Abraham Accords and you know, embrace and extend them and get Saudis on board with that was, I think, partly a reaction against that kind of thing. You know, China does something constructive, and just to show them who's boss, we do something that's not constructive.
Wait, if Iraq asks us to leave, shouldn't we leave?
Well, Syria would like us to leave. Are we leaving there? No, we don't leave countries that we're occupying.
But that's not answering the question. You were saying we should leave Syria too, huh?
Yeah, we should leave both. If Iraq really wants to go, we should leave. We should have left. We should have never entered Syria. Barack Obama said, don't worry, no boots on the ground. You know, a few weeks or months later, boots on the ground. That's our foreign policy. One more thing is this Houthi thing is nuts. I mean, it's like all the Houthi experts. I mean, hours before the Houthi attacks, and there's a thing about this in my non-zero newsletter. There's two consecutive pieces about Houthis, actually, in the last two issues. But hours before we decided to attack Yemen and hit the Houthi positions, Mark Leon Goldberg on his Global Dispatches newsletter had an interview with this guy, Gregory Johnson, who's one of the big experts on Yemen, saying, you know, the Houthis are trying to bait someone into attacking them because that's good politics for them, because they are having trouble governing. They're not great at governance. They now occupy a lot of Yemen, and things only work out for them when they have an external enemy. So they're trying to get somebody to strike them. And, you know, Biden delivers. And it's a completely hopeless task because, you know, it's interesting that from the get-go, the U.S. did not say we're doing this to deter the attacks on shipping in the Red Sea, because they know it's not going to deter. They said we're doing it to degrade. Well, degrading capabilities makes sense, like if it's a long, drawn-out war and every increment of degradation helps. But if your adversary's only goal is to disrupt shipping, degrading doesn't help, because disrupting shipping isn't that hard. I could disrupt shipping in the Red Sea. It's just not that hard. You've got to like invade and occupy if you're going to keep them from disrupting shipping in the Red Sea. So it's just a totally hopeless and stupid intervention.
Well, so you just, we're supposed to sit idly by and let shipping be disrupted?
No. We're supposed to say to BB, and this is the this is just the mind-blowing thing about this, okay? Biden, again, using no actual leverage to get BB to cease and desist and just do a fucking ceasefire. When the Houthis started disrupting commerce, they said, you know, until a ceasefire, we're not going to stop. And all of this other shit that's got people worried about a wider war, almost all of it is a function of the ongoing war in Gaza. But it would not occur to anyone in America that, well, then maybe what we should do is stop the fucking war in Gaza, much less that we actually do have the leverage to put real pressure on Israel.
And the Houthis will have won.
Who fucking cares? And then next time Israel launches an epic war, they'll do it again. Well, we've got bigger problems on our plate. Now, I want to add, some Houthi experts say that the Houthis have now gotten so much reinforcement for this, and the control of Iran over them is so overstated that it may be, I don't know, that now a ceasefire would not lead them to stop. But
I don't quite understand what your premise is. There's no way to stop the Houthis. I mean,
no, there is a way. Stop the war. Well, there was a way.
No sort of unilateral way. What if every time somebody launches a drone, a missile rains out of the sky and kills them? It's just a technological issue, right?
It's not hard to launch a drone. It is in the nature of drones that nobody has to be near the place they're launched from.
Right. And these attacks are from drones?
Some are. Some are missiles.
What about sophisticated anti-drone technology that knocks them out of the sky with lasers?
Well, you should send them some lasers. That might do it. But right now what is happening is we're using missiles that cost $1 jillion each to blow away drones that cost $1.50. And that is the absurdity of that is one thing that drove Biden to try to take out the launch sites or something. But, and even the missiles they use are much cheaper probably than our anti-missile missiles. But it's just like it's been so obvious that like if Biden were at all responsible, if he were the kind of president who worries, as he should, about, for example, the fact that America is more likely to suffer terrorist attacks, both targets abroad and at home, because of the war in Gaza and because America's like the big supporter and supplier of it. If he were responsible president in that sense, if he were responsible in the sense of trying to keep this from spinning out of control, if he were humane enough to care about all the civilians getting killed in Gaza, then he would put actual pressure on Israel to end the fucking war. And he hasn't done a bit of that.
If you were writing this article, you would begin by talking about the Barbary pirates, right? Because there we sent, it was a simpler world. Shipping was being interfered with by these pirates. Right. We sent a fleet with Admiral Decatur, I believe. And I also think his brother. And they boldly sailed into the port in Libya, and was now Libya, and boom, it was over. There was hand-to-hand fighting on the ship, and we killed the key guy, and the threat was gone.
Yeah, pirates are stoppable. We remember we did that once about, I don't know how many years ago. I think it was during the late Obama, but, we stopped the pirate problem by just killing some pirates. That's because those are human beings trying to board your ship.
Well, they didn't have drones. I think it's a technological issue.
Well, they didn't have drones, but drones aren't enough to commandeer a ship anyway. They can only destroy,
are enough to disrupt commerce. So they
exactly.
It was not just piracy. There's a few, Chris Hitchens. This is the best chapter in Chris Hitchens' book, which should still be a movie, called Decatur, where Thomas Jefferson sent an ambassador to, I think, London to talk to some Barbary Coast authority saying, what gives you the right to board our ships and impress our sailors? And this ambassador said, Islam. Islam gives us the right. So it's not just piracy. There was some ideology there. And so it's not completely dissimilar to what's going on now.
Well, the key dissimilarity is it was piracy, not drones. That's the reason what Biden's doing is futile. This is drones and missiles. And you're just not going to entirely wipe out the infrastructure they need to. You know, everyone is saying this. And the last thing I'll say is the irony is everyone is coming to realize that what's going on now isn't even in Israel's interest, slowly coming to realize this. There was a piece, today in the Times saying that, there's more and more of a consensus in Israel that there's no way to, quote, eliminate Hamas without getting all the hostages killed. And so they're starting to rethink.
Surely there's some other targets that Houthis value that we could destroy. I guess then we turn into MBS conducting a war against the Houthis.
Yeah, and they endured that. They endured it and thrived during it, okay? I mean, politically, the Houthi leadership. The whole problem in the world is that it is often in the interest of political leaders to foment conflict. It's in Bibi's interest right now to foment conflict. It's in, well, Hamas thought it was. They may have overplayed their hand. But you know, that's Putin. What leaders do.
Putin.
Yeah, and to some Putin. Extent. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, I've
over
calmed
to
down.
My hobby horse.
What's that? Yeah, I'm now sedated enough to endure some immigration talk. Shoot.
And then I have a killer transition for later. We'll find out. Biden wants to get Ukraine aid. We talked about this before. He had the idea that if I throw in $14 billion for the border, maybe the Republicans will go for my Ukraine aid in the House. The Republicans, you know, raised the stakes and said, no, this $14 billion is crap. We actually want some measures that will actually slow the flow on the border. So they've entered bipartisan negotiations in the Senate between Senator Murphy, your favorite, and Senator Langford and Senator Tillis, who are definitely not in my favorites. They're like very weak on immigration. And they're coming up with some sort of crap deal that now the press is, that Speaker Johnson is rightly resisting. It's a secret deal. We don't know what's in it yet. Okay. So everybody's talking and fulminating about a deal where we don't know what's in it. But we think what's in it, as I think I said, is some changing the standard from credible fear to reasonable fear to admit people in the country, proven to have a minimal effect, some expansion of the zone in which you can do something called some sort of rapid deportation, but it's not rapid. You still need a hearing, so it's not very effective. And not touching the parole authority that Biden has asserted to admit hundreds of thousands of people when previously it was, you know, a case by case admitting a few people at a time. So, or somewhere in between. It's a very bad deal. Johnson is resisting it, and the press is trying to put pressure on him by saying, well, hardliners in the House are resisting a carefully negotiated bipartisan deal, putting Johnson in a jam. Well, there is no jam for Johnson. He's worried that the hardliners in the House are going to oust him. And if he resists this crap Senate deal, the hardliners will like him. So it solves his problem. It doesn't hurt him. The only jam would be if he can't stand the criticism of the pro-Ukraine people and the press and the senators, which the whole job of a speaker is to resist the Senate. So I think he's up for it. Maybe he's not. But this is all going to play out in the next 2 weeks. I mean, they haven't released it yet. So I guess the idea is to release it 5 minutes before they vote on it. But it'll eventually become public when they vote on it. And DeSantis has an opportunity here. If he denounces the deal before Trump, it seems to be he wins some points. Now, he has already denounced the deal off the cuff on the stump. Trump has already truthed. He hasn't tweeted because he doesn't tweet. He's truthed to Johnson that the deal has to be perfect, but he hasn't said he opposes it. He just said it has to be perfect before you go for it. So DeSantis, there is a slight window. If DeSantis acts quickly, he can gain a few points. And Trump is sort of the danger is that if DeSantis comes out against it, Trump will of course come out for it. Mm-hmm. And Trump is a weak read on immigration. That's one of the reasons I like DeSantis. Trump, you know, may decide, that it's this will give him powers that he can exercise when he is president, which he expects to be. But so far, I haven't even heard any real powers that he can exercise when he's president. So that is one. There are two crap deals on the Hill. That's one of them. And that's the state of play. As distinct from the last time we talked, it's advance further, but we still don't know what's in the bill. There's a woman named Rosemary Jenks, who's the lobbyist for a group called Numbers USA, which is the most powerful restrictionist group. And she's sort of a no bullshit person, and says she says she knows what's in the deal and it's crap. So I tend to take her word for it.
So you think it's not, you think it is that the deal being offered to the Republicans is genuinely not satisfactory to earn a restriction.
There are things that would be so important that it would be worth even taking some of the responsibility off of Biden's shoulders. If he said, I'm willing to have a mandatory E-Verify system where all businesses have to check their employees, to see if they're legal or not, that would be worth caving and agreeing to the deal. And the caving isn't bad. I mean, I support more aid to Ukraine, so I'm not troubled by that. I just don't want a bill that takes Biden off the hook and doesn't do anything. But that would do something. So there's that. Or if he reinstituted the Remain in Mexico program, which worked under Trump, it was you can pursue your asylum claim just as you could in the USA, but you have to do it on Zoom from Mexico instead of while you're in the United States working where you will never leave. That would work. So that would be a big thing, too. And maybe the Republicans will get that. I mean, they have all the leverage here because they don't really want to give money to Ukraine anyway. So but at the moment, the press is pressuring poor little Mr. Johnson and saying, oh, you have to cave because the mighty Senate has decreed that this bullshit deal is the deal. And he is rightly resisting.
So you're predicting that? Are you predicting that there will be a deal?
No. If you want the overwhelming odds are that there won't be a deal, but there is a sliver of possibility that there will. That Biden, the other two possibilities that Johnson will cave, or that the Democrats will actually cough up some substantive reform after it goes to the House, and maybe there's a joint committee negotiating between the House and the Senate on some uber compromise that compromises the compromise. It's possible that Biden will cough up something significant. So I would say 60% it fails, 15% Johnson caves, and the rest Biden gives up something important.
Yeah. Bottom line, what are the chances that Ukraine aid does wind up going through?
Forty percent.
Because Ukraine. Well, they could also.
There are various ways they could try to put up, put a straight Ukraine vote on somehow. To up and down for Ukraine without all the border crap. But they're getting increasingly desperate.
If they could do that, they would have done it. All right. I mean.
Probably. There's one strategy that they haven't tried, which is, but if you're a desperate Ukrainian, you will try anything. Johnson right now has a one vote majority. Okay.
Yeah.
He actually has a 3 or 4 vote majority, but Scalise is out sick. Somebody else has gotten in a car crash. Okay. All it takes is one car crash and he doesn't have a majority. 2 car crashes, and Hakeem Jeffries is Speaker of the House. 2 sex scandals, and Hakeem Jeffries is Speaker of the House. So, right now, let's suppose there's an oppo file on all the 217 Republican congressmen, or however many there are, and the Democrats have been holding off publicizing some scandals because there's mutual assured deterrence. Republicans have scandals on them. And if there's all-out scandal war, there'll be many dead on both sides, and it's not clear who is going to win.
Well, so they're holding off. Scandals sufficiently explosive to get people to leave office before the election?
Yes. Yes. So it would have to be a scandal so bad.
This is just Mickey's paranoid brain working overtime.
Not paranoid. Paranoid, but some notable paranoids.
But not overtime.
How's this theory? Why does Speaker McCarthy resign instead of holding onto his seat to preserve the Republican majority? But he didn't care about the Republican majority, obviously. So his seat is not a safe seat. The election could go either way. So you know, there's a distinct possibility that before the end of the year, anyway, just through the course of death or car crashes, that Johnson will lose his speakership. And there's some evidence that some people don't care about that. So he's close to the edge already. And if you're Ukraine and you think Ukrainian and you think your nation is at stake, you're going to go through those Oppo files. And in 270 people, what do you think the odds are that one or two of them have a career ending scandal in their Oppo file? I would say the chances are pretty high. And the general rule is don't fuck with the Ukrainians. So that is an option.
So I think you think they're behind this?
That's an option that is undiscussed.
So it's Ukraine. You think Ukrainians are behind the plot to reveal?
No, but if you were a patriotic Ukrainian, you would get the hell you get yourself behind the plot pretty quickly. It's your best. It may be your only hope at this point.
Man, they are. I'll tell you, they are in trouble if the funding doesn't happen. But I still think you may be.
I can't believe that Biden can't reassign funds and give them surplus arms and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And What did Roosevelt do with Lend-Lease? I mean, let private actors amass funds to buy arms and give them to Ukraine.
There's things you can do.
The third countries overseas and have the private actors buy them there and ship them to Ukraine. I mean, I can't believe there's no workaround.
It's enough of a problem for Ukraine. They were sending all these artillery shells to Israel. I mean, above all, what Ukraine needs is artillery shells. I don't know how many we're sending to Israel. We're sending some. So anyway, welcome to the grassy knoll. As you know, I'm now a champion of conspiracy theories. I remain in the JFK assassination rabbit hole.
The Republican House members are falling pretty quickly. I mean, aren't they? I mean, they seem like they're...
Do you think McCarthy's... there was something behind his choosing not to hang on to the seat.
I don't think. I think he wanted to make a lot of money quickly, and he didn't want to do what Pelosi is doing, which is slog on as a backbencher when you've been Speaker of the House. But there are people, and I talked to some of them in Iowa, who have the conspiracy theory that there are Republicans who don't want Johnson to be Speaker for the rest of the year.
I didn't know there were any conspiracy theorists in the Republican Party. I'm surprised to hear that. So let me get an update on an answer to a question I've already asked you on the immigration thing. Right now, it sounds like the restrictionists just really aren't getting satisfaction. But is it the case that if Biden gave it to them, something that should, in theory, please them, then they would decide they don't want to give Biden the credit in the general election for having actually done something about immigration? Is that a
thing? Some would, some wouldn't. When this started out, the people, you know, the restrictionist lobbyists said, hey, maybe there's a chance to actually accomplish something here because we hold all the cards. Mm-hmm. They want the Ukraine, they're going to have to come through with something. And I think those people, including Johnson himself, would be for taking a substantial reform in exchange for Ukraine. I mean, Johnson nominally wants Ukraine in anyway. There'd be some, you know, some people on the right who exist by resisting and, you know, demonstrating to the world that they're resisting and calling for shutdowns at the drop of a hat, and they would resist. But the big players are saying they will bring down Johnson if he accepts a crap deal. They're not saying they'll bring down Johnson if he accepts any deal, even a good one. And they're not saying he should call off negotiations. So I tend to think there'd be enough Republicans to let Johnson bring it to the floor, where it would probably pass one of those center votes where there are enough Republicans and enough Democrats in the center to pass it and the fringes oppose it.
Okay.
Yes, I think the deal could go through. I don't think it's going
to
happen, but I think it could go through.
One more question about presidential politics. How likely is it that if it's Biden versus Trump, which it looks like it will be, that it comes down to whether RFK takes away, well, first of all, on balance, votes from Trump, which I guess is the closest to the conventional wisdom, as I said, he hurts Trump
Every poll shows nationally RFK Jr. helps Trump.
Really?
With RFK in the race, Biden is losing by more than, Biden is losing by more than with RFK out of the race. Swing states, that may not. The debate is whether in a few swing states, RFK actually hurts Trump.
Well, also, people will come to know RFK better. I mean, most people answering these polling questions have no idea what RFK believes about anything. They just have not paid that much attention.
Right, but there's the George Wallace RFK Sr. crossover vote. They were the same voters. So if you do nothing, they're basically Trump people.
Wait, the George Wallace
RFK? Angry white working class.
Wait, elaborate.
In 1968,
George Wallace was the third party
RFK
candidate.
Was shot and killed
right
after winning the California primary, and Wallace was in the race. And where did RFK's voters go? Did they go to Hubert Humphrey? No, they went to George Wallace. Shockingly to many people who thought Wallace was a racist enemy, RFK voters, supposedly liberal, unracist people, voted for Wallace because they were angry white working class people, even in 1968. It was a precursor of Trump. So now we actually have Trump, and there's a natural affinity between RFK Jr. voters. Either they know nothing about him except that he's Bobby's son, and Trump.
Well, there was also more of a tradition in the South then of not voting for Republicans. It was still more Democratic, although less so than before the Civil Rights Act.
Right, but I bet these polls were also for northern states. But maybe not.
So, that's not good news for me if RFK helps Trump.
And the other thing, anyway, Trump could kill this border deal pretty instantly if he denounced it. If we saw the deal and he denounced it, I think it's dead. Maybe not, but so that's the main reason it's likely to die. There's also a very bad deal on bad deal on the refundable child tax credit, where there's a Ron Wyden, Democratic senator, and a Republican committee chair named Smith have cooked up this compromise where the Republicans get a lot of business tax cuts. And the Democrats get an expansion of the child tax credit that still has a work test, i.e. you still have to work. The work test is you have to earn $2,500 in 1 year, which isn't a lot. Mm-hmm. But it cuts it in half and says you can also use it for next year. If you don't work anything next year, you can look back to the previous year. And various people are saying you've cut the work test in half. This is going to encourage some people not to work next year. And so that's where we're having a debate about that. And I'm hoping that provision gets dropped. But there are all sorts of people who are on the right, on the sort of reformicon right, I guess, who want to show that they care about workers and they care about income inequality. So they want to send these checks to, to poor Americans. And they're overlooking the disincentive effects of cutting the work test in half. And I think that's very bad. So the two most interesting things in my world are happening in Washington, not in New Hampshire.
Do you notice how stoically I endured that? Like when you brought up refundable child tax credit, I didn't even flinch. Did you see that?
That's because you were preparing your very intelligent question, which you're not going to ask.
What's an example of what an intelligent question would be? Can you do the honors for me?
Give up, Mickey, you've lost. That would be an intelligent question.
You mean on the tax on that issue
the tax credit is a precursor for the reason they like cutting the tax credit and work test in half, because then they can come back later and get rid of the other half, and the result is a universal basic income for anybody with kids. And then they can move forward and have a universal basic income for everybody. And you would say, Mickey, you've lost. The robots are going to displace all unskilled workers, and they're all going to live on the UBI. And maybe it'll AI will displace a lot of skilled workers, and they're going to be on the UBI. Well,
that's definitely the expectation. I'll tell you, another reason to check out the Non-Zero newsletter, I pointed out in this issue that two things that came out this week. One, at the high skill end of the ladder, there was this, you know, Google unveiled this like doctor bot thing that in these tests did better than actual doctors at diagnosis. They had like people kind of acting like they were patients chatting with it. And then they assessed like the bedside manner and rated that. But then experts assessed how good the diagnoses were. And the doctors, there were three conditions: doctors alone, doctors using the AI as guidance, and then just the AI alone. And that's the order of quality. The worst was doctors alone. Second worst was doctors using AI. The best was the AI without the doctor. Okay, so that's a high skill end of the ladder.
They should have decided whether the diagnosis was right by following it over time and seeing what the people died of.
Well, these were not real people anyway. But there are more and more studies suggesting that radiologists, for example, people who read, you know, x-rays and MRIs, they're just going to be out of work. I mean, it's just getting better and better. And I think it's to the point of parity. And they're just going to be out of work. Now, low skill end of the ladder, Sam's Club is starting to implement these AI systems. It's like image recognition and so on at these at the exits, that's going to put all the people out of work who now just check receipts, you know, the people stand at the doors and just make sure you got a receipt. They're out of work. And that's not exactly a high skill job.
I just went to a Walmart and I was looking for the person to check my receipt. And nobody did. Is that just because in New Hampshire, everybody is so honest, they don't need door checkers?
I don't think I've ever gotten that at Walmart.
Sam's Club is more downscale, so they have to check the receipts.
Well, or maybe more valuable individual purposes. I don't know. I don't know. They do this at Best Buy. But the point is, that's a low skill job that can be done by AI. This is going to be like an earthquake. I'm telling you, AI is going to be a total earthquake. Not just in terms of employment. It's going to be big.
This brings us to my transition.
Oh, good. What are we transitioning to?
You know, Nikki Haley is really an unappealing candidate, especially for her foreign policy views. She says, Israel doesn't need us. We need Israel. If Putin wins the Ukraine war, he's going to invade Poland and NATO. That's why we have to defend Ukraine. Mm. If Ukraine beats Russia, that means China doesn't invade Taiwan. So we have to support Ukraine. A bunch of very blobby bullshit views.
Yeah.
You know who funds the worst? Big funder of the worst.
Koch brothers?
Reid Hoffman, a man you just had a conversation with.
Yeah.
Funds.
I did. I wish I'd known that. I wish I'd known this then.
Funds Nikki Haley, the New York Times story about it. He gave her like millions of dollars.
Yeah, it's not about the foreign policy, though. It's just about keeping Trump from being president. She gets a lot of that kind of stuff.
Well, yeah, but so what?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, I wish opposition to the blob were much more widespread than it is? Absolutely. I'm quite aware that there's a reason they call it the blob. It's everywhere.
He probably is well aware that Haley is blobby. But, you know, he may be creating a Frankenstein.
Well, he doesn't agree with me on foreign policy, probably. Who does?
He doesn't.
Why would he? Who does?
I don't, because he agrees with you, because he's swayed by your logic.
Actually, the podcast, we even disagreed on AI. It was a good conversation.
I listened to the conversation, at least up until the very end when you started talking about, which is probably an interesting part of what was behind the Sam Altman firing and rehiring at OpenAI. Yeah. But I had reactions to it.
Go ahead.
First, he's a very nice but somewhat bland guy. He doesn't have a lot of bite to him.
You want him to have more bite?
Yes, because
maybe I should have provoked him more.
That would have been good. His basic attitude is, we can say, oh, there's these horrible problems with the AI without stressing the positive things that are going to come out of AI, which he doesn't like. And his attitude is we should pursue AI while negotiating the pitfalls and potential dangers. But he gives no faith that this negotiation is possible. He just says, well, we'll negotiate it. Well, nice try, Reed, but what makes us think, the people that built the Boeing airliners are going to be able to, or even smarter people are going to be able to negotiate these dangers, which he admits are real.
Yeah.
And so that was my main takeaway was he had to defend his optimism about being able to negotiate through the AI rapids. And the second thing is he was very short on positive things that are going to come out of it. I would say it's going to cure cancer. We're going to live forever. We don't have to worry about the birth dearth because we're all going to live to 200 and that'll supply all the people we need. Instead he said, well, people are going to have this doctor assistant in their phone and maybe the doctor will give accurate.
I mean, that's a real benefit. It's bad news for doctors, maybe employment wise, but that is a real benefit.
But you say, okay, doctor in a phone versus wiping out all humanity, which is more important?
Well, he doesn't think it'll wipe out all humanity.
That's the argument he has to make, and he's not making it.
No, he doesn't accept the premise of the extreme doomers.
Sorry?
He does not accept the premise of the extreme doomers like Yudkowsky. And I don't, I'm agnostic on their scenario. And he does not think the risks are as big as I do.
But he thinks there are risks of bad actors using this technology to do things like wipe out humanity. It's just there's less of a risk of the technology autonomously deciding to wipe out humanity without any bad actors in it.
Right. He doesn't buy the rogue, the rogue super intelligence takes over the world thing.
Right.
He thinks the risk now, all the benefits you mentioned, he's certainly aware of them. He wrote a book called Impromptu. He had access to ChatGPT-4 before the rest of us did, because he was at that point still on OpenAI's board, and he used it to write a book about all this stuff that came out right about time ChatGPT-4 did. And all that stuff's in there.
Do people know who we're talking about Reid Hoffman, founder of LinkedIn?
Yeah, well, that's the other thing I was going to say. And also, by the way, founder of Inflection, which has this AI bot called Pi, which is interesting. People should check it out. Pi.ai. One thing I wish I had said, he was kind of complaining about how few optimists there are on AI. And it is an unusual case where, capitalism has failed to do adequate public relations. You look at the public opinion polling and you look at it over years, and anxiety about AI is much higher in the public than it was 2 years ago, 4 years ago.
My point is, he's exhibit A of failing to make the positive case. If he was making the public case, he would go, here are the 10 earth-shattering advances we're going to make with AI. Okay.
Well,
we're going
to if you're immersed in this world, you assume everyone's aware of all the upside. And I was asking the questions, to some extent I was steering him away from that.
He had many opportunities to do it and he didn't do it. He talked about this doc in a box. Okay.
I think it may also be partly that I know him well enough that it was more like he was having a conversation with me, and he knows I know all this shit. So I don't know. I mean, I do want to say one thing. I wished after, when he said, name some people who are being optimistic about AI, and I kind of conceded there aren't a lot, but in terms of the public's skepticism, a lot of this is a consequence of the way social media worked out and the way Mark Zuckerberg was telling us it was going to be wonderful, and it turned out to be the opposite. And I think maybe one reason, I mean, I'm sure Reed's aware of that, but one funny thing about him is he created the only non-toxic social media site I'm aware of, which is LinkedIn. You may or may not like it, but it's not a hotbed of bad shit. What?
Why is it non-toxic? You said that. Why is it? You said that on the show, and I was wondering, why is LinkedIn non-toxic?
It was established as a place where people use it for professional purposes. And I think it has remained largely that. I think there's more, maybe more political discourse on it than there used to be. But it just, you know, it's partly because of the how the conversation was constrained.
I don't even know what is a LinkedIn conversation. It's like, hey, I'm out of a job. Does anybody here know any job openings? Is that like a LinkedIn conversation?
You know, it's look, I don't spend much time on it. I'm not in the kind of profession where, you know, I'm not like trying to get myself new jobs and stuff or trying to hire people or whatever. But I think it's a little more, it's probably a little more self-promotion-y than, well, everything's full of self-promotion. But I mean, you know, people are like getting their brand out. They're personal. This is what I do for a living. This is why I'm good at it.
Why would you go to a site to learn about other people's brands? That's what I don't understand. Sounds like hell.
Well, it's worked. I mean, he sold it to Microsoft for a lot of money, and that's why he's on not a direct consequence of the sale, but he is on Microsoft's board.
Do people say, hey, got any company secrets you want to leak to help me out with this problem I have?
No, it's like networking. You know, networking is a big part of professional life for a lot of people. It's like the place where you do the online network for the professional dimension of your life for a lot of vocations. Yeah. I don't know.
Okay. Anyway, I thought his AI Pi has a sort of touchy-feely positive aspect to it, too. And I thought it sort of like nudges you in the right direction if you're angry and sort of doesn't help you. And it made me want to write a dystopian science fiction novel where the villain is not an evil AI chatbot, but it is a friendly Reid Hoffman-like AI chatbot who somehow in all of his friendly guardrail-heavy advice saps human life of all its vitality and interest. Sort of a sort of AI version of Fight Club, you know? We're all controlled by this wonderful Pi and we're at peace. And anytime we're angry, it calms us down so we don't have rich human interactions and get the pleasure of getting really angry at somebody and then get them getting really angry and us coming to some sort of rapprochement because everything is stopped by the Pi chatbot friend before it happens. I don't know. It seems suffocating to me.
Well, maybe you should try. Have you tried it?
No, I'm angry.
What?
I'm too angry.
Maybe you should try it before you write your novel. But
I hate that Nikki Haley person. I hate her. It's going to say.
Yeah. Nikki, I mean, on balance, I don't think you have to worry about AI having that effect because, and this is somebody I brought up, the incentive of the average AI company will be to just maximize engagement. And social media has taught us how you do that. You just play to people's prejudices, make them feel good in the easiest way possible. And that reinforces their cognitive biases and leads to.
But he isn't going for, he is, I thought he said on your show, he is not going for engagement.
Yeah, he is more thoughtful than many. And he is more genuinely thoughtful.
I don't know what he is going for, but it's
he is genuinely more thoughtful and philosophical. In fact, he majored in philosophy, I think, in college than the average Silicon Valley billionaire.
I've learned how to not care about engagement. In other words, every time I write something that's mildly critical of Trump or mildly positive about Biden, which is not often, my traffic goes down and I lose followers. And this doesn't bother you if you don't have many followers to begin with.
So. Wait, it's every time you write something that's what?
If I write something that's outside my brand. In other words, if I dump on MAGA, dump on Trump. I have a lot of people who follow me who are Trump followers, even though I'm not voting for him. So if I criticize him, they drop off. They cancel. My numbers go down.
Yeah, I'm increasingly increasingly indifferent to feedback.
If you have nothing to lose, you have nothing to lose. So that's my solution.
For example, what did somebody say to me today? Said, "Damn it!" It was something like, "I'm so disappointed. I've been a follower of yours for a long time, but I'm so disappointed in you."
He's not angry, really, but he's sad.
He's sad. It's more out of. I had been kind of casual in, what did I do? There was this tweet. Oh, I needn't bore you. Somebody wrote, a country where the choices between Biden and Trump is in a crisis of unfathomable proportions. And I quote tweeted it and said, unfathomable may be a bit of an overstatement, but yeah, basically this is true. And this guy was upset with me for saying that we're fucked. Now, it's true that the guy who I was quote tweeting me. It's a long story. But anyway, we're in a bad place, Vicky.
There is one ray of hope.
What is that? I need it.
You know who Trump is considering for his vice president?
You?
Most of them are all terrible. Tim Scott's not up for the job. At least Stefanik, it seems like a genuinely evil opportunist.
Tim Scott's applying for it. He applied today or yesterday when he endorsed Trump. But go ahead.
Stefanik's been applying for it for, you know, a year. She doesn't even make any bones about it.
Can I make a prediction? My prediction is I will not be nearly as gratified by whoever it turns out to be as you think I am going to be. Who is it?
You're gratified if they're good or bad.
Oh, well. Oh, that's a tough one. I thought you meant it was somebody that relatively friendly to my ideology.
Save the nation. J.D. Vance is.
You're aware that I don't like J.D. Vance, right?
I know. So what I meant, it was semi-ironic, but you will learn to like J.D. Vance because he's the best of the bunch.
What a sad comment on the bunch.
He's completely up to the job. He's a solid character.
He's a complete panderer to the worst of populist sentiment. He's a complete panderer. He'll say anything. He's worthless.
He engaged in bipartisan rail safety talks when there was an accident in his state. He didn't.
Well, good, because you know, Mickey, when people ask me what issues are at the top of my list, I always mention rail safety. I'm so worried about being on a train that crashes.
His instinct was to be constructive, not to hurl epithets at the Democrats.
Constructive on a completely milquetoast issue that, A, nobody gives a shit about, and B, there's no controversy over whatso-fucking-ever.
It's not completely milquetoast. There's an argument that Republicans deregulated too much, and instead of having two people on every train, they had one or something like that. And we needed to re-regulate, and that's a big issue.
Anyway, I meant to say last time when you said Bobby Kennedy could be Trump's running mate, it hit me only too late that you first heard that from me months and months and months ago. I was stealing it from either Bill Scheer or Matt Lewis, I forget, but you did hear it from me first, and you went, not bad idea.
Okay, I believe you.
I don't think it'll happen, though.
I'm looking for renewed respect for Cornel West, but.
I like Cornel West. You know, I had an office next to his at Union Theological Seminary. In fact, there was an adjoining room. Our assistants occupied the same room in between. So we each had kind of office suites because we were like important guys.
Why aren't you running for president?
You know, you're not the first to ask that question.
Glad handing skills
yesterday?
I think you do.
I don't think I'm a natural politician, but
I think you have more glad handing skills than I do.
But this is how bad things are. I would give Biden a run for his money. Anyone. This is the weird thing. This crystallizes it. There are so many people who could give Biden a run for his money and so many people who would beat Trump. Folks, there's an opportunity here. Come on.
There is a name out there that we are not thinking of.
Look, these names might be
Bruce Springsteen.
The names are not the problem. The problem is finding the names who would run.
No, right.
Again, Tim Kaine could knock off Biden, knock off Trump in his fucking sleep. All it takes is like a normal sentient human being.
Probably somebody who Biden sort of pissed off in his climb up the ladder, except he climbed up the ladder at age 29 and hasn't left.
Well, again, I mean, it's like, you know, Chris Hayes wrote a book called The Twilight of the Elites, I think. And I didn't read it, but I assume that it's about what has actually happened, which is that
I read it fast. It's about how we don't have a real meritocracy anymore. In fact, the danger is that we might actually have a real meritocracy, and it would be the nightmare of Michael Young's The Rise of the Meritocracy.
Never mind then. But
you missed the point.
What I increasingly realize is that cohesive and coherent societies need some degree of elite cohesion.
You think it's bad that the chairman of Boeing can't stop air doors from falling off and jumbo jets from catching on fire, and the head of United Air performs as a drag queen on special occasions? Does this sap your faith in the elite?
Man, now I'm not sure where the segue was there, but I see. Does this sap my faith in elites? No.
One of the big raps on elites now is Boeing used to be the best air company in the world, and through successive generations of capitalist success, it's now badly managed and its airplanes crash. Whereas an industrial policy company, Airbus, a socialist company, not a capitalist company, is beating the crap out of Boeing, and its airplanes do not fall from the sky.
I'm on board with the moral of that story, but but what I'm saying is that there needs to be some degree of cohesive power held by elites for societies to function minimally well. I'm just saying, like, the Democratic Party, you need a party where when everyone agrees that the incumbent is a disaster, they do something about it. They can do something about it.
Well, the cohesive elite is the blob. The blob is a cohesive elite. So the blob should have power to get rid of candidates.
That's a good point. The blob is the only cohesive elite. The only cohesive elite community we have is the one who is destroying the fucking world with terrible foreign policy. That's a good point.
What is the relationship between Davos, which is going on now, and the blob? The blob is a subset of Davos? It's a foreign policy wing of Davos or not?
It's a mystery why global capitalism is not more anti-blob than it is. Because you would think that the capitalism would want to make the world safe for itself and create a stable platform. This has long been a question of mine. I think maybe there was a time when that happened, when like the Council on Foreign Relations was a little more of an extension of Wall Street. And that has its downside if, you know, capitalism controlling foreign policy. But if they emphasize stability, they sure as hell wouldn't support what American foreign policy has been. And remember, stability often is synonymous with peace and instability with tons of people dying.
John Ellis made one good point about Trump. This is a different point than your point is, but I just, it reminded me of it. Trump, and this is, he's drawing on some articles by McKay Coppins about going to Trump rallies, is the Trumpist movement is now, has taken on a mind of its own. In other words, people go to the rallies, they listen to Trump, but they don't really listen. They leave before Trump has spoken. It's not about Trump. Mm-hmm. They are the Trump blob now. Trump is riding back into office, but if Trump dies, they're not going to go away. They're still there, and they have a certain degree of independence from Trump. That's interesting. Previously, it was he was like Perón, right? Or maybe the Peronist movement had a mind of its own, but it was a, you know, one man politics. And it's not anymore. It's a coherent group in American democracy that you have to deal with.
No, I think that's true. And it's easy to miss that because Trump does have such control over it right now.
But it sort of controls him. I mean, there was the famous incident, my greatest hit when Trump, as he's very unreliable on immigration, he could go either way. He's very unreliable on the refundable child tax credit because he loves to send money to people. He thinks he buys their vote if he sends them cash, and they'll love it. And he's probably right. So he could go either way, but there was a time when he wanted to sell out on immigration, and people started burning their MAGA hats, and there were only like two or three of them, but they were on the web, and one of them was me. Trump was intimidated by his followers. Oh, I can't piss these people off. They're going to start burning their MAGA hats. So it's not like he controls it with an iron fist.
No, it's the same with actual dictators, too. Nobody, there's no such thing as a true autocrat.
There was a big book written by a guy who was a big Trumpist, the guy who wrote the Flight 93 election. That guy.
Was he at the Claremont Institute or something?
He's at the Claremont. He didn't write the book. He wrote essay about the book. The book is about the Emperor Cyrus, who apparently was the most successful person at ever building an empire that they actually did control, that didn't control them.
So the metaphor is that, like, you're voting for Trump, and yes, you know it's going to, like, be the equivalent of the airplane you're on crashing, but you still have to do it. Is that it?
Oh, the Flight 93 election was election. If we elect Hillary, it's disaster. So we have to
bring the plane down. Is Flight 93 the plane they brought down? The let's roll plane? Yeah.
Yes. So we let's roll with Trump because the end result
is otherwise
the plane is going to crash into the Capitol and kill every member of Congress. So
yeah.
I think
fatalistic isn't the word, but I think we're in such a mess. I mean, in so many ways. I mean, American institutions are completely ill-suited to governing in the current technological climate, and I don't see how they get revised to become, you know, to adapt. I just don't see it. And in general, the world is totally fucked up, thanks in no small part to American foreign policy, and there's all these tribalizing dynamics, and increasingly, it's like, I don't really have all that strong a preference. How do I describe it? It's like, you know, sometimes you just decide what, like, the future is so uncertain. It's like, for things to work out well, something dramatic is going to have to happen, and it may have to be very painful for a while, right?
So you're becoming a Lee Kuan Yew type autocrat where you want
I'm just saying, you know, in past elections, I've always had like a strong preference, usually, you know, and I really think it matters. And like, I really think Obama's better than Romney because his foreign policy will be better. And Obama will be better than Bush, which he was, and so on. And now I just think, like, we're so fucked. It's hard. It just seems like recovery is enough of a long shot that it will happen through some unexpected path. And it may be a disastrous Trump 4 years that has to happen. And it may be something else. And I just don't fucking know. What I do know is that the answer is not RFK Jr. or Nikki Haley or Joe Biden or Donald Trump or, you know. So I'm just like fastening my seatbelt. And I'm just going to, you know, express my version of what I think the problems are and what I think our values should be and what the challenges are. But it's not looking good. I'm sorry.
There are a lot of people who agree with you. Like, everybody I talk to agrees with you. So,
well, yeah, but a lot of them think they have the guy, right? Like, a lot of Trumpists.
No, they all think we're in this horrible dilemma and there's no way out.
Yeah, but isn't just this presidential. I mean, it's not just Biden versus Trump. That is a horrible dilemma. But they are just symptoms. They are just symptoms.
They think the problem is Biden versus Trump. But they don't have a solution.
Biden and Trump are symptoms of something deeper.
So if Biden and Trump were replaced by the president of your choice, why would we still be hurtling toward catastrophe?
Well, oh yeah, I could identify a set of policies that would straighten things out. I mean, look, I do care enough to, I don't want Trump to be president. It's just that Biden, given what we've seen of his foreign policy, given the fact that he is too old, and given the fact that if he dies, we get Kamala Harris, it's just Biden, you know, I would vote for Biden over Trump, but it's just, it's not so clearly superior that I care as much as I otherwise would. And I can imagine a scenario where four more years of horror with Trump, which it right. would be, are somehow a it's like the way World War I gave way to the League of Nations, World War II to the United Nations. Like, big reforms tend to come in the wake of catastrophes.
So the calamity will be cleansing. The I think it's obvious what the long-term horrible trends are. So yeah. AI, meritocracy, disease, terrorism, et cetera, et cetera. So I guess I shouldn't mock that.
I wouldn't sign into all that, but yeah.
You could go for a bolt hole.
What's a bolt hole?
Look for a harmless third country where you could move to while the world falls apart.
Become a prepper.
Yeah,
that's a form of prepperism.
Yeah.
Yeah. Prepperism is expensive. You need money to prep well.
Okay. You can make money by selling prepper goods to preppers.
That's a better idea.
You give them not only the tents and the dried beef jerky, but you will also sell them the ideology that tells them why they need the tents and the dried beef jerky.
Excellent idea.
You can become the L. Ron Hubbard of preppers.
Like every pack of beef jerky has inside it a little guidance from me.
Or on the wrapper. It's like the
Dove chocolate wrappers.
That peppermint soap you buy, Dr. Somebody's peppermint soap. It has one world slogans.
Mm.
Actually, you would agree with that soap. You should invest.
I'm going to go get some now.
I'm through all my
bullet points. Yeah, well, then unless you want to talk about the JFK assassination, it's time to go, because that's all I've got left.
Can you give us three sentences on what you think the solution to the JFK crisis is? JFK conspiracy?
I think it's a little late to come up with a solution since all the people who participated in it,
you think it's the latest solution is, which I think you hinted at, is that a secret serviceman behind him in the motorcade accidentally fired his gun?
No, I didn't think that. Who thinks that?
Apparently that's a common theory.
Oh, Jesus. There's so many crazy theories.
And the guy took the guy is taking the secret to his grave, or already took it to his grave.
I think an underappreciated fact is that conspiracy theory isn't entirely synonymous with multiple shooters. You can imagine rogues in the government, in the CIA, having kind of steered Oswald toward this and just thinking, hey, if it works out, great. If it doesn't work out, I mean, if their goal was indeed, partly they hated Kennedy, but also to blame an ostensibly pro-Castro guy for it and thus start a war with Cuba, they'd be like, well, what's the worst that can happen, you know? So he misses. it doesn't have to have been more than one shooter. I would say that. On the other hand, that said, the shooting itself is completely, there are these contradictions I just cannot resolve in terms of the evidence about the shooting itself.
Your RFK Jr. might be your candidate. I assume he's bought into this conspiracy theory too.
Oh, yeah, I assume. I mean, I think I told you that he remembers his father, RFK, right after the assassination. Some CIA friend of theirs comes over And Bobby said to him, tell me your people didn't do this. And the guy says, I don't know who did it. But the point is that his father's, Bobby Kennedy's suspicion was.
Well, that's a completely rational reaction to have as your instant reactions. Mm-hmm. The question is, 20 years later, do you still have it? Was Bobby Jr. There when his father was killed?
I doubt he was there. He would have been still probably what, like a teenager or something? I don't know. But the but one thing, you know, Bobby was still attorney general when the assistant attorney general, this is right after the JFK assassination, Nicholas Katzenbach wrote this memo that we now have. That basically said, you know, in White House memos, like, okay, this is the story. Americans have to be convinced that there was one shooter and blah, 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 and that he would have been convicted if he had lived and blah, blah, blah. I mean, there's just no doubt that the Warren Commission was set up in an atmosphere of like, this is our story. We're sticking with it. And Bobby, I think, would have been probably fine with that, because part of the whole motivation of tamping it down was to keep the right wing from turning it into an occasion to wind up in a war with Cuba and even the Soviet Union. I applaud that motivation.
What would Glenn Greenwald say? He would say you're part of the problem. You're willing to lie for your cause.
I am part of the problem. So, Mickey, I can tell that you don't share my fascination with JFK assassination. Time to wrap this thing up.
I think our viewers might not share the fascination. And Mickey, I used to be heavily into it. It was like there was this comedian, Ort Saul, who had a show in LA, a talk show. And every week he'd have a new Kennedy conspiracy person on. And I became very fascinated with it. And he became so fascinated, he eventually moved to New Orleans and went to work for Jim Garrison. As a Hollywood comedian. So that's how into it he was. But
I never went through the phase. In fact, I now can't believe I was in college in Fort Worth for a year. Easy drive to Dallas, never went to check out the site. Amazing. I remember the assassination, but I never got into the rabbit hole. It's such a great rabbit hole.
You should shake. Somebody should do a rating of all the great rabbit holes.
This is the best. There's so much shit out there, and you will never get to the bottom of it.
But if you actually go to the school book depository, it will winnow down the field.
I've already ruled out a lot of shit.
Okay. Yeah. So anyway, if people want a special, you should invite somebody like Mike Isikoff on, who knows all about.
I doubt he's brushed up lately. I mean, if he was I would like to have a conversation with someone who could answer all my questions.
He's written a book about Fannie Willis. So,
who's she?
Prosecutor prosecuting Trump for the Atlanta. You know. I want you to find me 6,000 votes or whatever that is.
Oh yeah.
And it's the book is titled Find Me the Votes, I think. And Byron York pointed out today that at no point in the transcript does Trump actually say find me the votes. He says,
I just need X number of votes. Well, yeah. Well, that's a pretty subtle fucking distinction, Byron. Thanks for sharing. What did I want to say? So is Ron DeSantis, my point is that's not much of a distinction. You take the point. That's not much of a distinction.
No, I like Isikoff, so I'm glad that the headline of his book is justifiable.
Last question. So is one reason DeSantis is hanging around, and may hang around for a long time in your view, because who knows, Trump could wind up in jail and enough voters could say,
there was one poll that showed Trump losing like 20% of his support if he's convicted, which was stunning. I can't believe that. That's stunningly high, in my opinion. But it's possible.
And who knows whether they'd follow through. But
And who knows what the conviction will look like? Will it look legit? Will it look not? So, But there's enough of a chance that it'll have an effect that we're sticking around. And also, he just, all he has to do, you know, he can run in 2028. He's the conventional wisdom is he's just running to groom his, to have an off ramp and groom his path to 2028. And, you know, if he does the Robert Mitchum thing in 2028, he's home free.
There ain't going to be no 2028 for this guy.
Sorry?
I just think this is his last run if he loses. And he's going to lose. So DeSantis.
No, I don't. Why should it be his last run?
Because he's a famous failure. Everybody is the one thing that can bring America together at this point is the consensus that Ron DeSantis is a terrible fucking candidate. Everyone agrees.
What if first he's getting better and better. What if he retools and finds Jesus and becomes, emerges a new man, reborn like a phoenix from the ashes of his old campaign?
I think that plus the unkept hair. Yeah, I could do it.
Okay. And maybe an inch higher heel, maybe. Yeah.
That would look good. He would look good in heels.
You know, that was an issue in the campaign that he actually wears lifts in his shoes.
So does Tom Cruise. Works for him.
And if the Ukrainians come up with dirt on every other politician in America, it's like
he's home free.
It's like, you know, would you go out with me if I was the last person on Earth?
Maybe.
The answer is yes, we would.
All right. On that note.
Okay.
This was epic. There's nobody listening at this point. So you can say anything you want. Is there anything you don't want anyone to know? Go ahead.
Have we got over 2 hours? No.
We're right at two, I think.
Okay. Good place to stop.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Are you going to follow this thing? You're not going to Nevada for the caucuses, no.
No, last time I did because it's right by LA, but where I live. But
you going down to South Carolina after that?
No.
No, so you're done. This is the end of your Hunter Thompson phase.
Correct. New Hampshire used to be the last place where all the reporters in the world could get together in one place and schmooze, and it's not even that anymore.
You have discovered that it's not that. Okay.
Or maybe they're all in a secret speakeasy. Like, you know that in Des Moines, there was a secret speakeasy under the hotel where all the big shots were.
I didn't know that.
And I actually discovered it, and it wasn't that exciting, but there were big shots there. And so maybe there's a secret speakeasy under the, you know, Residence Inn in Manchester where, you know, everybody's trading secrets. But
well, I'll let you go find out now. Do check in if there is. Let me know.
Okay. I will.
And I think they're all in the metaverse probably, so you should check there too.
Doing unspeakable things to each other, yeah.
Which you can, again, no one is watching or listening. You can speak him if you want. If you're thinking of specific acts.
No.
Between consenting adults, go ahead.
Nope.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll see you in the next campaign. Mickey checks in from.
In the next verse, yes.
From the campaign verse, yeah. Okay.
Okay, see ya.
See ya.